Welcome to Hot Wash. We're Trudy Henson
and Christine Gentry, legal and public health experts working in emergency management and public health preparedness at the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security. This podcast is our exploration of topics that come up in our line of work. And since it doesn't always make the best conversation at parties, we're taking it to the airwaves to share with other interested individuals. Whether you're an academic, an emergency management or public health professional, a student, or the interested public,
we hope to shed light on legal and policy issues that arise, delve into planning and operational areas that don't always make the headlines, and tackle emerging issues. We take our jobs very seriously, and we'll explore serious topics in this podcast, but we'll also take the opportunity to explore the lighter side of emergency management.
Well, welcome everybody to our first episode of Hot Wash, Law and Policy of Emergencies.
Welcome everybody. This is Trudy. Christine, before we get started, what is a hot wash?
Trudy, don't you know that by now?
Well, I probably should, but just in case.
So a hot wash, I think the term originally came from the military, and it's used most frequently in emergency management after an exercise or a real-world emergency. And it's the process of essentially going through and saying what went well, what didn't go well, and what can we improve for next time.
I see. All right. Well, then it makes sense for that to be the name of our podcast. Since we're going to be talking about emergency management and public health preparedness, and what happens and why it happens that way and what can be better or different. All right. So, Christine, how did you end up here?
You're just so inquisitive this morning.
I have a lot of questions.
Okay. I have a JD and an MPH, and I was very interested in health and environmental law and policy, and sort of ended up in the field, I hate to admit, accidentally, through public health emergency preparedness. It was an incredibly interesting field that I really, really enjoyed. And so I've worked here at the center for the past, it's coming along my six-year anniversary this year. So turnabout is fair play. How did you end up here?
I kind of ended up along the same path. I came to law school. I was interested in health law policy and got interested in homeland security and public health preparedness. And I've been at the center now for over 10 years.
Wow.
Yeah. A little long in the tooth, yeah, as they say. Okay, so we're going to get into the title of this podcast. This episode is 100 Years After the Great Molasses Flood, Emergency Management and What Has Changed. You may be asking yourself, what great molasses flood 100 years ago? And Christine, I think you're going to help us with that.
Yeah. So, great question, guys. If you ask yourself, what is the
Great Molasses Flood?
I'm here to provide you with some background. So, January 15th, 1919, Purity Distilling Company, which is a subsidiary of U.S. Industrial Alcohol, was using molasses to make alcohol. They'd set up the operation initially to make alcohol that was used in munitions, but after the World War, they were transitioning to sort of drinking alcohol, especially in light of upcoming prohibition. So they really wanted to make as much alcohol as possible as quickly as possible.
Obviously.
Yeah. Around lunchtime that day, there was a huge tank of molasses that exploded. Now, you could be asking yourself, how big of a deal could that really be?
Right. It's some syrup.
Yeah. Some syrup places.
And places it wasn't supposed to be. It's sticky, but
yeah, what's the big deal?
Yeah, is that a problem?
Let me tell you about it. It was a problem. on initial hearing about it, it sounds kind of silly, but it was a huge deal. The tank was absolutely enormous. It held 2.3 million gallons of molasses.
Oh, wow.
It was about 90 feet in circumference and 50 feet tall. So, ginormous.
It's a big tank. Yeah.
And the explosion itself caused about a two-story tall wave of molasses.
Oh, wow.
Experts have figured out that it traveled as quickly as 35 miles per hour. There's no getting out of that oncoming wave.
That. Yeah. Right.
Fun little fact, apparently molasses is a non-Newtonian substance.
And what does that mean? For those of us who don't know what that means.
For purposes of this podcast, it doesn't matter.
Okay. That won't be on the quiz.
No quiz, yeah. In addition to the wave of molasses itself, the tank exploded, causing things like rivets and small pieces of tank to burst out like bullets, essentially like shrapnel, and hit people and injuring them.
So you have metal flying out in addition to a 35-foot wave.
Yeah.
Traveling at 35-foot wave or 35 miles an hour?
For 35 miles per hour.
Two stories high.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So think about the destruction that happens after a mudslide.
Right.
The wave of molasses picked up buildings. It crushed entire buildings, poured into people's homes. There was a mix of sort of residential and industrial in the area.
And this was, is this Boston?
Boston's North End. Okay. Oh, sorry, I don't think I said that.
Okay.
Yeah, so it poured into people's homes. At one point, it destroyed a section of the elevated train.
Wow.
So the Boston Post has this kind of terrifying description of it.
As if this isn't terrifying enough.
Yes, yeah.
We have some description from back in the day.
Back in the day, yeah. So the Boston Post wrote, "Molasses, waist deep, covered in the street and swirled and bubbled around the wreckage. Here and there struggled a form. Whether it was an animal or a human being was impossible to tell. Only an upheaval, a thrashing about in the sticky mass. Horses died like so many flies on sticky flypaper. The more they struggled, the deeper in the mess they were ensnared."
Wow. And so what was kind of the outcome of that?
So 21 people died.
Okay.
There were around 150 injured. And in today's money, it cost about $100 million.
Wow. So one of the things that I read was that it smelled in that neighborhood like molasses for 4 years afterwards. Because even though they did the cleanup, it just kind of lingered.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really interesting. And then I think the other thing that I read that was really fascinating to me was they had a difficulty with cleanup because even though the tank itself had exploded because it got hot, the weather was actually cold.
Mm.
And so then the molasses cooled and sort of super cooled.
Mm.
And then you're kind of dealing with
hardened, yeah,
kind of frozen molasses that you're trying to clean up.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So it's actually very terrifying and makes a great case study for us about 100 years later.
Yes.
So, Trudy, one of the first things that comes to my mind when I think about this scenario is who's responsible, both who's responsible in the initial aftermath for responding, life safety and incident stabilization, et cetera, and then who's legally responsible.
Yeah, I think that's the first question that pops into most people's minds. So who is responsible for that initial response for the cleanup of the flood or the rescue? I mean, at first it's going to be a search and rescue mm-hmm. kind of situation, at least in modern times.
Right. And that's how it unfolded back in the day. Apparently, the first people who responded...
The first on the scene?
Yeah, were 116 cadets. Yes.
Okay.
And a lieutenant from the USS Nantucket. Then also responding, we had Red Cross volunteers, police, Army and Navy personnel, and the fire department.
So there was actually a pretty robust response then.
Right.
That's pretty analogous to modern day in some ways.
Right. One of the biggest differences, of course, is these were all spontaneous volunteers.
Okay.
The cadets just ran. You know, they saw the explosion and were like, yep, we can help with that.
All right.
So good on them.
Right.
But spontaneous volunteers, of course, mean that no one organization was in charge. Nobody knew exactly who was there. So if someone had gone into a building that was not structurally sound and maybe the building fell over,
would they know if that person was missing?
It's
right,
a toss-up. Yeah.
Okay.
Medically wise, so since there were so many people injured, 150 at least, we had volunteer doctors also sort of spontaneously arrive on scene and essentially set up a field hospital.
Oh.
And back into the day, ambulances were run by funeral home directors because they were one of the only sort of people who had vehicles and wagons and things that people could lay down in.
Makes sense.
Yes. So it may be a short ride if you're very if you're very seriously injured.
Oh yeah, hopefully.
A streamlined, you know.
Cross purpose.
So yeah, so it was a pretty interesting response. A lot of different organizations represented, but some clear differences to how we would respond today.
And what do you think the biggest difference is from then and now?
I think it's the coordination. I mean, if something like this happened nowadays, citizens would probably get out their iPhones and record the incident, but some of them would also hopefully call 911. And so at 911 call centers, the dispatchers would be able to do the initial coordination. They would send out police and fire. They would send out the rescue squad and a lot of ambulances. They would be able to pull resources, not just from whatever first due we're in, but also from using like mutual aid from different jurisdictions to pull in a number of resources. We also have the incident command system that is right. used by first responders. So that first, whether it's police or fire, whoever's on scene first, would take charge of the incident. They would be in command until, of course, you get like a battalion chief or somebody who shows up. And so while people are responding on scene, there's also a mobilization of the local emergency manager's office.
Right, which is it's a big difference from 100 years ago. We didn't have
right.
such an office.
No. Emergency management really wasn't a thing in the civilian world at the time.
The other question is, who's responsible from a legal liability standpoint, you know, and to put that in sort of modern terms, like, who are we going to sue is the question.
I mean, being lawyers, that pops into our heads.
If we don't ask it, someone's asking us, who can I sue?
Mm-hmm. Particularly with something this damaging, $100 million in today's money.
Yeah, so that's a big check. So in terms of legal liability, it sounds like maybe the company that built this tank is going to be the ones found ultimately responsible. There's a lot of reports that the tank was built hastily, maybe because there was that deadline of prohibition looming. And I think, Christine, you mentioned that there were reports of kids that would go up in the streets and scoop up molasses on mm-hmm. sticks and make sort of impromptu lollipops because the tank was already leaking, mm-hmm. I think pretty much from day one. And so one of the questions that often comes up with these kinds of disasters is that company going to be held liable for that, mm-hmm. what sounds like negligence?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one question.
And I think ultimately, right, they were.
They were.
Yeah.
That's not always the case. A lot of times the disasters, you can't necessarily find someone that is responsible in the same way, especially when
right.
you're talking natural disasters.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the question gets a little more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But there, we certainly see some of the same issues. You know, are buildings built to withstand the disasters that are the areas known to face or might face? And who's responsible if those systems fail?
Right.
So another question that comes up with these kinds of events is, did we know this could happen?
Mm-hmm.
How could this happen? Did we know this could happen? Did we know that this was even a threat or a danger?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it sounds like maybe in the north end of Boston, people were aware the tank might be leaky.
Yeah.
Maybe they weren't aware that the tank could explode. And so that leads to the question a lot of times in disasters, man-made or natural, when we see some of the secondary effects, did we know this could happen?
Right.
So mm-hmm. how do we deal with that in modern times?
So in modern times, local emergency management offices very frequently do threat assessments. They are most familiar with whatever is in their area, either sort of the natural hazards, you know, some of the jurisdictions on bodies of water, like the bay, know that they're susceptible to flooding in certain areas.
Right.
But local emergency managers also are familiar with what is in their jurisdiction, be it like a college, well as, I'm not suggesting college students are dangerous.
What kind of dangers does college present?
That's not, just sort of large population centers.
Okay, population area.
Yeah. Also, industrial hazards.
Okay, so like chemical plants?
Right. So today's emergency managers do these threat assessments, and they also take part in mitigation efforts. Mitigation in recent years, it's been getting a lot more attention. There's a lot more federal and state efforts to make things as safe as possible.
Before something happens.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So in knowing what's in your backyard, essentially, is one way of mitigating.
Right, exactly.
Because you need to know. And we've seen this, what I think of when I think of threat assessments and the outcomes of natural disasters are some of the floods that happened in Texas. And I think there were some chemical plants that exploded
mm-hmm.
because they were flooded. And those were near residential areas. I think there were neighborhoods like one street over. And so that's a sort of modern example of, I'm sure that the emergency management agency there knew about those chemical plants
right.
and mm-hmm. had that information
mm-hmm.
and knew that was a possibility. And
yeah.
that's a difference, I think, from 100 years ago.
Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about what's different now in terms of the response structure that happened.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other things that come to mind when we're talking about this? Because when I think about what's different from 100 years ago, I mean, like you were saying, people would break out their phones and start recording.
Right.
So yeah. Social media and media in general is completely different. But are there other things that you think of that come to mind?
I mean, I think we've had a huge shift in just sort of attitude about emergencies. I think more and more emergency management recognizes cascading effects of emergencies. It's not just the immediate explosion of the molasses tank,
right,
but it's also you have numerous displaced people, you have hospital surge, you have people who witness this horrific scene who need crisis counseling, who need maybe long-term support. You have local businesses that have to institute some sort of continuity plan in order to stay in business.
Right.
So I think there are a lot of things that we recognize now that happen during an emergency, and so we're able to plan for them in a more robust manner. And also, I think we're a lot better at bringing in potential partners. It's not just police and fire and hospitals. It's also like Department of Housing and Department of Human Services, Department of Social Services. I think we're better at partnering with non-governmental agencies as well.
I was going to say, I think one of the differences that we've seen, especially in the last several years, is the bigger emphasis on public-private partnerships.
Oh,
so bringing
right.
in those mm-hmm. private companies and what they can bring to the table and support.
Right, which is a lot, yeah. And I think maybe the final piece, you already sort of touched on it with social media, is I think we're doing a lot better at integrating technology into response, be it sort of communication technologies or GIS mapping.
Yeah, that's been a tremendous game changer, GIS mapping.
Yeah, that's my two cents.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right, well, I think that's going to wrap up our initial inaugural first episode.
Yes. Yeah.
Is that enough?
I think those are enough firsts. Yeah.
First. For Hot Wash. So we'll be back. Thanks for listening.